Okay, here we are, February 24th, 2008, lecture discussion number 33 on Genesis 1 through 19. And once more, at least, we are staying in Matthew 24. Still a few items to address. That's this list over here before returning to Genesis. So this, think of it as an interlude or an intermission, and it'll continue this morning, and we'll have to see how far we get. Might make it all the way through today. Keep in mind, making it all the way through isn't really an accurate way to portray it, because this is a surface study. There's a tremendous amount that remains to be gleaned in Matthew 24. Specifically, you have to put Matthew 24 with Revelation, with Luke 21, with Mark 13 in order to figure out what's really going on, and Matthew 25 as to what is really going on here. And all we did was rake the surface. And that's okay. We don't really have the ability Sunday morning to do anything but rake the surface, so that means that you're the ones with the shovels. You're going to have to dig through it. Don't think it's easy. It is not. And for those of you who try to read ahead, and I hope there is a few of you, there usually are, we're going to go towards Melchizedek next. And that's Genesis 14 and 15 and Hebrews 7, 8, 9, and 10. And again, don't try to read Melchizedek without both parts of it. And that's not the only parts. There's many parts through Scripture with regard to Melchizedek. But essentially, 7, 8, 9, and 10 of Hebrews and 14 and 15 of Genesis, and you've got to read them together. If you try to read 14 and you don't have Hebrews 7 at least, you're not going to approach it successfully. Melchizedek is an extraordinary subject that requires a great understanding of what particular system, just off the top of our heads. Yeah, the priesthood, the sacrificial system. You have to understand what Melchizedek represents and who he is. And as you know, I have the position that says Melchizedek is a Christophany or a theophany. That is Christ himself there. Okay, Matthew 24. Here we go again. Christ's responses to the three questions. Important to know that it starts out with three questions. The whole purpose of Matthew 24 is to answer three questions. So if you don't know what those three questions are, and you don't know what order that he answers them in, then automatically you're going to wonder about and have some difficulty. This list on the board that's here, it's been here for quite a while now, a couple of weeks at least. For those who might have missed the last couple of weeks or maybe visiting this morning, this is a dissection or a parsing of Matthew 24. And Matthew 20, and this is Christ's second answer. This is really Matthew 24, 9 through 28. So this is the parsing or the dissecting of his second answer. And he answers the first question of the disciples second. So the disciples asking three questions. He does not answer them in order. What he does is he answers their third question first. So they go 1, 2, and 3. What he does is answer three first. And then he answers their first question second. And that's what this is, over here to the left. And then he answers their second question third. So that's the way he does it. And failure to understand that is a certain path to interpretive misreading. So very important to know how to begin here. So now we're going to try to catch everybody up, at least kind of sort of start together today as best we can. It's necessary for one more time to read the disciples' first question and follow it again by the reading of Christ's second answer, so at least everyone can figure out where we are. Now, I need to put this disclaimer before we do that. I am aware, none of you have come up to me to tell me this yet, but I am aware that amongst the Bible scholars there's great disagreement on Matthew 24, 9 through 28. And they see differences between Luke 21 and Matthew 24. And some will say that Matthew 24, 9 through 28 is not an answer. Let me say it this way. He's answering the second question, they will say. Whereas Luke 21 answers the first question. So effectively what I'm trying to tell you, I know this is just a whole bunch of blah, 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 but it'll come up as you go through it. They will tell you that Matthew 24 only has the answers to questions 2 and 3. Now, obviously, I disagree with that, because I am saying that Matthew 24 is dealing with the first question. And it's not really worth bogging down and trying to figure it out, but I'll just say to you this way. Matthew 24, 9 through 28, obviously to me, is Jerusalem in the tribulation. It is the campaign of Armageddon being discussed. It is the Antichrist being discussed. I think that is clear. We'll go through that again as we go through Daniel 9 immediately tells me it's the Antichrist. The signs and wonders tells me it's the Antichrist. The inner rooms tell me it's, the desert tells me that it is Satan. So I understand Matthew 24, 9 through 28 as being in the tribulation. And Luke 21, 12 through 19, the key phrase there is this one: but before all these things. So Luke 21, 12 through 19 is a different time than Matthew 24, 9 through 28. It's specific. Luke is specific to the time of the apostles. Matthew 24 clearly is talking about the tribulation. But Jerusalem is the focus of both of them. One is Jerusalem at 70 AD, time of the apostles, when the apostles are gathered up and executed and martyred. Rome siege, Titus. And Matthew 24 is after the apostles are gone, and it is specific to the Jews. Okay, anyway, let's go back. And that means nothing to you, and I know that. Don't worry about it. As I said, that's just something that people will argue in classrooms and universities. But you need to know the argument is there. You'll read a commentary that will tell you Matthew 24 doesn't answer the first question. And then you'll read one that says it does. So here we go. Matthew 24, verse 3. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, very important to note, privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be? And these things is the destruction of Jerusalem. When will the destruction of Jerusalem be? Well, there's two destructions of Jerusalem. There have been quite a few destructions of Jerusalem, but three specific ones. Nebuchadnezzar, even though he didn't do a lot of damage, he just killed a lot of people and left vassals in his place. Eventually he comes back and does more damage, but the Romans destroyed it, stripped it almost to the ground, killed a million people, perhaps more. They were after their tax money. Where was their tax money? It was in the temple. So how did they get their money out of the temple? The tax money was in the gold that was in the building. It was commingled with the rocks. And so they tore every rock down, took the gold, and then killed everybody and said, next time, pay your taxes. Pretty much the same system we have today. Okay? You don't think that's true? Try it. See if they don't come and strip your house of wood and insulation to get their share. People tell me all the time, I own my house. Ha! Just don't pay the state taxes and see who owns your house or the property taxes. Anyway, how did I get on that? Oh, yeah, the Romans. There's another one. There's another destruction of Jerusalem, and that is in the campaign of Armageddon, when the Antichrist leaves his city, his capital, which I believe the evidence says is Baghdad, and travels to Jerusalem. And by the way, as he travels to Jerusalem, a wonderful thing, the Kurds come out and attack him from behind. That's one thing they do, and that's why that's such a fabulous thing that's happened in your lifetime, is the establishment of Assyria again, after all these many centuries. Okay, so, and the Ethiopians, by the way, also fight. So always pay attention to the Ethiopians and the Assyrians, because they do cool things. Tell us when will these things be? In other words, the destruction of Jerusalem. And he answers them in verse 9. And you have to decide who the you is. Is the you specific to the apostles, or is the you to the entire nation of Israel at the time in the tribulation when they are destroyed? And I think the key here is that it is Israel. So let's now start at verse 9. When will the destruction of Jerusalem be? And he says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Who is the source of the false prophets? Who trains the false prophets? Well, the false prophet trains them. Who's the false prophet? He is the second beast that rises out of the earth. By the way, what's that mean? I have a beast that comes out of the sea, and I have a beast that comes out of the earth. What's the difference between the sea and the earth? And Ben and I, by the way, just for grins, I'll throw this in. Ben and I argue over, don't argue, we discuss over who this false prophet will be. Coming out of the earth. If I pull you out of the earth, what's that seem to you that I'm doing? What's that? You were dead. That's right. So I want to know what dead guy is the false prophet. Now I take you out of the sea, where do I take you? Some commentaries will tell you the sea is always the Gentiles. Well, the sea isn't always the Gentiles. It's not always the Gentiles. Sometimes it's judgment. Sometimes it's Gentile nations. In other words, Israel goes into the Red Sea and comes out of the Red Sea intact, if you will. The Red Sea doesn't destroy them, but you get a picture of Israel being dispersed among the Gentiles, but then coming back together. Okay, I'll give you that. I also see the Red Sea as judgment there. The Israelis come through it at Exodus. They make it to the other side, and the judgment falls upon the Pharaoh and his army. So most of the time, the sea, there will be no more sea, he says in Revelation. That's no more judgment, not no more Gentiles. Point being that you can't always assign the sea as a Gentile. And so those who say that the Antichrist will come out of the Gentile nations, well, maybe. I don't think so. I will argue that I believe the Antichrist is Jewish. There's many reasons for that. One thing for sure, he understands Jewish religions, the religious system of the Jews. Anyway, if he's coming out of the sea, and it's not the Gentiles, and he's not coming out of judgment, where's he coming from? Because it says the Antichrist comes out of the sea. Yes, I think that's where the abyss is. He comes out of the pit. How did he get to the pit becomes the next question. Over the next few weeks, yes, 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 I'm going to get into some very controversial stuff. Where was I? And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Thought I lost my place, didn't you? Didn't you? Yeah, I am a professional. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. We covered that last week. That's the end of the tribulation. He who endures to the end of the Jew who makes it through the end of the tribulation will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. Then the end will come. The end of the age of the Gentiles. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. When God says, try to understand, what's that mean to you? Bring a lunch. This is a lot of work here. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of the house. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation as opposed to just plain old tribulation back in verse 9. Such has not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor shall ever be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, and the subject is the nation of Israel, they are the elect here, those days will be shortened. Who says that? So what's the chances of those days not being shortened? He's going to shorten them, isn't he? Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will rise. Not only will false Christs and false prophets rise, but they are in the employ of the false Christ and the false prophet. and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out, or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. The vultures will be gathered together. Okay? Hopefully now, you understand what this list is. This is key elements of it taken out and put in order, and we're taking them on one at a time. And previously, we have blasted through most of the items. We've touched upon quite a few of them. You may not have recognized it. I do it in a very subtle way where no one can see me. It's devious. But the point of it is that I really don't want you to just sit in here. Who was it that was? Oh, it was Amanda called me yesterday. Look, if all you do is come here and listen to me, you will go absolutely nowhere. Because one, it is impossible to pour it into you. You have to utilize it to get it, which means you're on your own. How is it that you learn Matthew 24? Amanda had a wonderful idea. She's awfully young, so she doesn't remember me doing this. But on Wednesday nights, I used to do what, for those of you who've been here a long time? Yeah, I used to give tests. And I'd hand them out. Like any good teacher would. It's what I've been taught to do, right? Give the lecture, test on Friday. And I'd hand them out to see if I'm getting through. And I found out very fast, as normal, most people don't learn by listening. Most people do what when they listen? Yes, it's right. They sleep. It's what they do. I understand that. I'm not offended by it. I want you to be rested for the hard week to come. I need you on the framing crew. So I really don't. I'm positive you're not going to learn. It's basketball to me. I hate to keep going back to sports, but that's what it is. It's sports to me. I can tell you how to, where to put your hands, how to get your leg in the right position, how to turn the body, how to keep your head back, how to drop your head over, how to concentrate on the hitting zone. I can tell you how to bring this thumb up your button line, make sure that if, I got to be able to put the thumb in my mouth, the finger in my... I got to get... But if you never shoot the ball, all you do is watch me shoot or watch me hit. You're one of these, man. You're three pitches and you're coming back to the bench to be an assistant coach. You're never going to get on the field. You have got to take what you learn and try to give it to somebody else. That's how it works. And if you don't, you won't learn it. You need to sit down and explain this to somebody who might be interested. It's better if they're slightly interested. This is where tormenting your children comes into play if you have them. You sit them down and say, I'm going to explain to you Matthew 24. Who's really going to learn it? You are. The kid is going to fall asleep and scream, Mom, make him stop. I used to have a kid used to come here, sit next to his mom, and about now he would say, Mom, can you make him stop? No, you can't. Okay, so you have to take this and utilize it to learn it. Now, we've asked pretty much all the whats, but now we're going to try to take on the whys, at least one why. Let me get a nice red pen. One Y today, if we can. F and G. Lawlessness. If I say to you that lawlessness has come and love has grown cold. Oh, I saw a really sad story in the paper the other day, actually on this place I go to. It's kind of more of a national paper. Love growing cold is a horrible, horrible thing. Young lady, no, I won't even tell you. It was so horrible. I don't even want to deal with it. I won't get through it. It's just a very tragic story. I don't want to get bogged down. Love growing cold. The great tribulation shortened. The elect, no flesh should be saved. Okay? All of those have a particular element to them. In fact, the signs and wonders also, and the look here and there, all of those have an element. They have a common piece, if you will. They are parts of the Satan, Antichrist, false prophet plan to exterminate the Jews. They're the betraying, the killing and the hating, all of these things. But these primarily are the ones where his plan comes to the forefront. This plan that Satan has in the tribulation to kill the Jews should make you step back and ask a key question. Why does he want to kill Jews? What is in it for him? See, that's the obvious question. What's his point to killing Jews? What's his choices besides killing Jews? Why is he singling out the Jews? Why does he want to kill them? What have they done to him? Is kind of the logic behind it. I'm being funny there. But you have to ask the question. What's his point, his plan? How does this benefit him? What is he trying to prove, if you want to go that direction, by killing the Jews, if anything? The tribulational killing of the Jews is the fulfillment of all of these other killing of the Jews that has happened. There's many killing of the Jews, but this is the antitype. Now, when I say antitype, you need to know that means the pinnacle or the fulfillment of it. The prophecies are the shadows. Christ is the antitype. The types and the antitype. Christ is the one that it points to. Not against type, but fulfillment of type. And that's a theological term. Herod and the Pharaoh, for example, they killed children in what many theologians see. They killed Jewish children in an effort that many theologians see to thwart the birth of Christ. Did they thwart the birth of Christ? No. So you would think once the birth of Christ occurred, there's no sense in killing any Jewish children anymore, right? Why would I kill children now? He's been born. I should stop. Did the killing of the Jews stop after Christ was born? No. So why is Satan killing Jews? What's his point? He didn't stop anything with it yet. Should have stopped killing them. Is it vengeance? You just don't like them? See, he's a lot smarter than that, isn't he? One of the key elements of the plan of Satan and the Antichrist is the extermination of the Jews. And you have to say to yourself, what? Why is he doing that? Why doesn't he kill bowlers, golfers? I mean, why did he pick the Jews to kill? And woe, by the way, to those that are pregnant. Pregnant Jews, they got big problems. And that has been a discussion. Jewish infants will be sought out again and slaughtered at a level that we can't imagine. That's a big problem. See, and this all happens in the Great Tribulation, not the Tribulation. The Tribulation is the first 3.5 years of the 7-year period. Okay? So here I have the Tribulation. But right here I have the Great Tribulation. That's when he decides, that's when the time comes that he goes out and slaughters as many Jews as he can. He can't do it fast enough. The second 3.5 years is the Great Tribulation. Satan is thrown to the earth, Revelation 12:9. He knows that he has but a short time, Revelation 12:12. And the killing accelerates. And this is when the Antichrist breaks the covenant and he tears into the Jewish nation and the Jewish people and kills them as fast as he can. He accomplishes 9:27 in Daniel right here, declaring himself God and abominating and desecrating the Holy of Holies. And here it goes. And the worshiping, by the way, of Satan through the Antichrist sweeps the earth. If you worship the Antichrist, you're really worshiping Satan. Does Satan know he's not God? Oh yeah, he's got that locked up now. There was a couple of times where he thought otherwise, but now he's got it made really clear to him. When he gets thrown to the earth, no doubt now. And the mark of the beast is a mark fundamentally of worship. That's what he's doing. He's making people worship him. Why? He knows he's not God. Why? What's the point? Killing Jews, having you worship me. Just an ego trip? Is that what he's on? No, he's not. He has a plan. How does it fit together? This is the eighth of the 11 mysteries, and I can't say this enough, what we're talking about today. It's the eighth of the 11 mysteries. What's the key word there? Mystery. It's a mystery. It is 2 Thessalonians 2:7-9. It is the mystery of iniquity. It is the mystery of the man of sin. It is called, mystery is called a hidden truth. How good did he hide it? Who's he hid it from? Everybody. That includes us. What are we supposed to do? I guarantee you the unsaved have no idea how to find this. They have no idea. When I talk to an unsaved person about the 11 mysteries, they just look at me like I am totally crazy, as opposed to you who only look at me as if I'm partially crazy. And it's obvious which ones I'm talking to. They have no understanding at all and no interest. You might as well talk to the floor. At least look at it. Find the blue specks. Count the blue specks per 2.5-foot sections. The winner gets to go through the buffet line first. Have I counted the blue specks? No. Did I ask how many blue specks per tile? Yeah. I did. No, they go all the way through. You have the front and the back and the sides. They know exactly how many blue specks. I asked them. I said, I'm going to buy these blue specks. Am I going to see blue? She promised me I would see blue. I don't see it. Looks black to me. Anyway, getting off on it. The mystery of iniquity, the mystery of the man of sin, is a hidden truth. He also says this, great is the mystery of godliness. Got in this conversation last night when I came here to turn the heat on. Great is the mystery of godliness. That is God becoming man. How big a mystery is that? Great. Who said that? Paul. Who told him to say that? The Holy Spirit through Paul wrote, great is the mystery of God becoming man. Are you going to struggle with Jesus Christ being God and being man? Absolutely you are. Great is this mystery. It'll all get to you eventually. But here's the man of sin, the Antichrist. They're all hidden truths. The son of perdition, the Antichrist, is a great mystery. Don't assume it's easy. Don't assume that Hollywood's got it right. Don't assume that most theologians have it right. They don't. How do you figure out these mysteries? You meditate over them. You pray for wisdom. You use your reason that he gives you, Hebrews 5:4. And you search the scriptures as you go through the mysteries. It's the Holy Spirit, by the way, who reveals the secret, the deep things of the scripture to the mature. So one of the ways you become someone who knows the mysteries is you become mature. How do you become mature? Yeah, that's one way. But you leave behind the elementary principles. So the first thing you need to know to learn the mysteries is you better find out what the elementary principles are. Think math. You don't take trig until you take algebra, right? You don't take algebra until you can add, subtract, divide, multiply. If you're still counting on your fingers, probably not going to get through the mysteries, because that's a Calc 4. And the Holy Spirit reveals the secret things to the mature, 1 Corinthians 2:6-16. The Antichrist is one of the deep hidden things, and it's extraordinary. Now remember, we're approaching this, all of this, from this position of why. Why this focus on killing the Jews? And as I said, it's obvious from history that killing Jews is a popular thing. You have the Pharaoh, the Assyrians, the Romans, Stalin, Hitler, the Spanish Inquisition, etc. Killing Jews is the thing to do throughout history. But why? As I said, especially after the birth, the death, the resurrection, and the ascension of Christ, once that was complete, why does he still want to kill Jews? Satan is not foolish. He's not omniscient. He's not stupid, though. And he certainly is wicked, and he's vengeful. And he seeks to be worshipped by humanity, but there's a plan and a purpose to what he's doing. And it is wise for the wise to know the plan and the purpose. So at least you can see it around you and explain it to others. And he has an understanding of something that we really don't have an understanding of. Satan does. He has an understanding of the physical death of humanity. He has caused so much of it, he knows how it works. Satan must know, having witnessed so much death, that physical death is what? It's a transition. That's right. It doesn't freak him out like it does us. He's seen billions die by now. Delights in it. The physical death isn't the issue to him. What's the issue to him? What death does he have to worry about, for example? Yes, he has to worry about the second death, the eternal death, Revelation 20, verse 14. Okay? It's the second death that is of insignificance to Satan. His own second death is coming, and the second death of humanity, for most of humanity, is also coming. There are some who will not go through the second death. What do we call them? The saved. That's right. Satan intends for man the physical death, the second death. He knows that the physical death of a believer is temporal. To a non-believer, physical death leads to the second death, which is eternal. And so ultimately, this is Satan attempting to bring that second death in. Now, when you look at what he's doing, though, I think that you'll find that he is making an accusation against God. He is making an accusation, because how many die? That's an easy question. Yeah, everybody. How many are saved? Okay, here's the dead people. Of the dead people, how many dead people have we have? If you take Henry Morris's pre-flood position, and I do, there's between 6 and 8 billion prior to the flood, humans alive on the earth. How many we got now? Alive on the earth now. 6 to 8 billion. How many have died over the last 4,000 years? Oh, we'll throw another billion. So, how many we got? Okay, 20 billion. Is that right, Troy? Yeah. Exponential notation. Got to check with Troy. That's 20 billion. How many are saved out of the 20 billion? Come on, give me. You can participate here. It's not very many. Okay, I'll give you this. This many. That many saved. 2 million. I know there's millions because I got Revelation to tell me that. But I certainly, out of the 20 billion, it's not very many. The path is narrow. Okay? Percentage is bad. What's the obvious question? Whenever I do this, by the way, whenever I stand up and say, hey, by the way, 20 billion are going to die the second death. This little group over here is not. What is the first thing I get from the crowd that when I put that out there? That's not fair. That's right. It's not fair. Ultimately, that is the accusation of Satan. He is saying, I believe, that he is attempting to bring God's solution, which is Genesis 15, to trial. And he is accusing God of being unfair. God is unjust. He has put together a system where very few make it out of billions. That is not just. That is one of the five lies of Satan. He is unfair. See, love demands that all are saved, and holiness demands that all are condemned, right? And so the solution should accomplish at least what? 50%? That ain't happening. 50% aren't making it. You would think the solution would be heavies, but it's not. The solution is a very small percentage of the total are saved. And the accusation is that this is unfair. See, God provides himself to the condemned as a substitute for them. He provides himself to be condemned in their place. Accepting the substitute, believing that Christ is God who has come, John 8:24, believing in his name, 1 John 5:13, is the solution to the second death. But most don't do it. They don't believe. They don't accept Christ. They do not. I ask this all the time. Do you believe that Jesus Christ is God? And they say most of the time, no, I don't believe that. If it's true, what have you done? You said God's lied, one form or the other. You're declaring that God is a liar. So you can see, think it through. If you declare God is a liar, what's going to happen? You'll perish. And so many perish and so few live. Is it fair that so many perish? And that is the accusation of Satan, I believe. And if you find yourself uttering, at least is it such a thing, at least you should know what the origin is. Okay? Now, back to this. Revelation 12:12. That's an important piece. At the midpoint of the tribulation, 3.5 years in, Satan is cast to the earth by God. Is that fair? Yes, it's fair. Here's what it says. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time. So when he's thrown down, he decides it's time to do what? I have to do something now. I've been thrown down. What is it I have to do? I have to kill Jews now, fast, hurry, because I have a short time. I have to kill Jews. Number one thing, we have our meeting, false prophet, antichrist, Satan get together. Hi, I've been thrown down. What we got to do now is kill as many Jews as we can. Great tribulation comes. Great tribulation starts because he knows he has a short time. Wholesale slaughter begins. The covenant broken. Antichrist and Satan become one. This because he knows, cause and effect, running out of time, kill as many Jews as possible. And that there's the obvious question. Why not just start killing everybody? See, he has a limitation, Satan does, doesn't he? What's his problem? Yeah, I think he's probably given up on that by now. But you're absolutely right. He can't do what God can do. Yeah. See, God can kill everybody, can't he? Satan can't do it. Satan has a real hard time killing anybody, and he needs something to do it. What's he need? Yeah, he needs help. He needs assistance. He needs employees. See, how exactly does Satan kill the Jews? What's his method? As Bill just said, he's not omniscient. He doesn't even know where they all are. He's not omnipresent. Can't find them all. He's not omnipotent either. He doesn't have the power. Beside his deceptions to tell you otherwise, killing a whole bunch of Jews isn't easy. It takes planning. I have facilities. I got to round them up. How do I do that? He needs help. They need men to kill men. So his plan of killing the Jews really boils down to this. He wants men to kill men. He wants Jews and non-Jews to kill Jews. Why is the killing of a Jew by another man what he wants to do? He's got to hurry up and do it. The killing of the Jews is elevated. It's a characteristic. Let me show you Matthew 25:31. It's a significant thing. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory and all the nations will be gathered before Him. So Christ has come now. We are in the 75-day interval, by the way. That's Daniel 12:11 through 12. It's the blessing of the 1335th day. Blessed is he who gets to the 1335th day. Why is it 75? Because I've got 1260. 1335 minus 1260 is 75. 75-day interval. That make any sense to you at all? Kind of, sort of. See me later. I want to get to this 1335th day. If I make it, I get to go into the millennium. If I don't, big wampum, heap of trouble. So here we are. We're now going to see who makes it to the 1335th day. He's got all the nations in front of him. So he's going to judge. He's going to separate them out. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as the shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. So what have I got? I got sheep. Column A, column B, I've got goats. And I have a column C. I have number 3. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you came to visit me. I was in prison, you came to me." Now, was he in any of those? No. He's in heaven. He's the high priest. He's now come as king. So who's he talking about? Who's the I there? Someone represents him. Yeah. Well, the believers are the sheep. They're already on the list. He's already separated them out. Then the righteous will answer him. That's the sheep. Saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick and, or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of my brethren." So he has his "my brethren." They're on the list. So who are the sheep? Those are the righteous, the saved. Who are the goats? Who are the "my brethren"? If you did something to my brethren, if you took care of them during when? During the tribulation, you're saved. Then he will say to those on the left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in." If you take in a Jew during the tribulation, what's going to happen to you? Yeah, you're going to be, yeah, not a good thing, huh? Who does it? Who takes in Jews knowing that if they're caught, they're dead? Not just dead, slaughtered, tortured, brutalized. Who does it? Sheep do. Who betrays them? Goats do. He is separating people out that have lived through the tribulation. You go on that side, you're a sheep. You go on this side, you're a goat. Based on what? How you treated the Jews in the tribulation. Why is that the criteria? And by the way, if you're saved, you will do what in the tribulation? You will take care of the Jews. You want a salvation test? Can't get a better one than this during the tribulation. Those who take care of the Jews during the tribulation, saved. Those who don't, cursed. Why is that? Does Satan know it, by the way? He knows this is the criteria. How does he know this? How does he know that the criteria... See, if I can get you to kill Jews, what are you? You're a goat. And you're going to be cursed. I got to get you killing Jews. Many Jews I can. Make as many goats as I can make. Because he knows the report card is coming. Why is this the criteria? Now, I'm going to tell you what is evidence of salvation. People ask me all the time, "What is evidence of salvation?" I tell them, "Have you killed any Jews in the tribulation?" They look at me like I'm... Yeah. But at least I got one. I got evidence of salvation right here. If you're in the tribulation and you betray and kill Jews, you are not saved. It can't get any clearer. It is evidence of salvation. It doesn't save you. It is evidence that you are saved. Does that make sense? But Satan knows this. He knows it. So, that's the question. Why is it that during the tribulation the saved will have this characteristic of protecting the Jews and the lost will kill them or betray them or not care about them in any way? Why is that? What is it about the Jews that causes this in the tribulation? I'm out of time. Well, they do. The remnant does, but the apostate Jews don't. Apostate Jews are right in there killing their own brethren. Yes, ma'am. You is dead right again. A for Carolyn. This is all about typology. Did I spell it right? The Jews represent Christ. They are a type of Him. Okay? God, Christ, even says in Exodus 4:22, go to the Pharaoh and tell him to let my firstborn go out to worship me after a three-day journey. How long a journey, by the way? Three-day journey. 3 days and three nights. He didn't stutter. No Friday crucifixion. Sorry. Okay, I'm not really sorry. Fake sorry. Okay. Now, I want you to think about what that is, the typology element that the Jews have in the tribulation. How is it that killing a Jew in the tribulation is the same as rejecting Christ? Right? Satan knows that. He knows every time he gets someone to reject Christ, that he has a goat. Now, I want you to, as we musicians come forward, this is just for fun. Next week we'll finish all of this, I hope. How many comings of Christ do I have? I have two comings of Christ. So what's the obvious question? We're talking about who right now? The Antichrist. If I have two comings of Christ, how many comings of Antichrist do I have? You would think that I would have. You would think that Satan would know I've got two comings of Christ. I've got to have a perfect plan. I have to have a perfect counterfeit. I would have two comings of Antichrist. So what's the obvious question there? When the Christ came, would the Antichrist come at the same time and be side by side? Would that be logical? Yes, it would be. It's going to be that way at the tribulation. They're going to be side by side at the tribulation. When Christ came, was the Antichrist on the earth? If he was, what's the obvious question? Who is it? Okay? Some of you have had me go through this, and you're ready to go through it again, I know. But many have not gone through this particular element. Christ came as the prophet, didn't he? And he had a death, a burial, a resurrection, and an ascension. So if I have an Antichrist, I should expect the Antichrist to come as at least some kind of religious figure and have a death, a burial, a resurrection, and a descension. Wouldn't I? Christ is in the high priest position right now. I would expect the Antichrist to be in a similar position. Christ comes and is revealed as the King of the Jews, and primarily he's revealed to be God himself who is the King of the Jews. So I would expect at some point that the Antichrist would be revealed as well. As what? He'd be revealed as the counterfeit, as the son of Satan. Right? Do both come? Did both come and one ascended and one descended? If one descended, where did he go? See, here's a wonderful thing. This is where you get to fix your Bible. It's not my favorite thing to do, but it's in the top eight. Revelation 13:1. Okay? We'll all read it together. Ready? In a very loud voice so I can hear every one of you. Revelation 13:1. First word, then. Second word. How many? What did I hear? Say again. He. How many he's I got? Raise your hand if you're a he. Careful. How many of you have then I? Okay. The word is not I. Cross it out. The word is he. And it isn't. It's referring to not John, but Satan. Then, your good Bibles, it should have a little note that says most manuscripts read he stood, referring again to the dragon or Satan. Satan is the context. Notice the, and the dragon was enraged with a woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Then he stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and his horns ten crowns. Satan stands and calls out the Antichrist from the sea. Calls him out. Okay? So Satan knows where he is, knows who he is, calls him out. One of the most fascinating things, remember, this is a great mystery, the man of sin. One of the fascinating things is that we have one person in all of Scripture of who it is said has gone to the abyss. One person. His own place. There is no other person of this that is said. It is said only of him, and that person is Judas. So the obvious question is Satan calling Judas out of the abyss? And if he is, that's an extraordinary thing. And next week, we will do that again. Let's rise and be dismissed.